Well, hey, everyone, and welcome to this week's show. I am your host, Lisa Anderson. First up in the order of business is, have you checked out our new Boundless.org? Redesigned, migrated, new features. We're getting some great feedback on our new blog as well. If you have not joined the blog community, make sure you do that. Check out Martha's post on how to fully set up your profile and go from there. And then start commenting and let us know what you think. Also on Facebook, you can give us a shout or write to us at editor@boundless.org with your feedback, because we are compiling that and taking it to our IT folks as we make some tweaks in the process. So welcome to the new Boundless. On this week's show, later on, we have Candace joining me by phone to answer a question about getting a second date. Wah, wah, wah. If any of you feel like you just never can get a second date, you have to listen in on this one. Then for our culture segment, we have the wonderful and illustrious Glenn Stanton, our family researcher here at Focus, talking about cohabitation. I'm going to give you a spoiler alert. It's not okay, but we're going to talk about why. And then here we are for our roundtable, speaking of living arrangements, on places that you live while you're single, arrangements you have in living while you're single. Should you buy a home? Should you live with roommates? Should you live with a family? We have people here that have done it all. So here we go. Mr. Andrew Hess. Hey, Andrew.
Hey.
Great to have you.
It's good.
Anthony Ashley is here. Hey, Anthony.
Hi.
Good to have you.
Thanks.
I like your shirt. It's kind of colorful.
Yeah.
In a subdued sort of way.
Exactly.
I'm digging it. Yeah. And a new guest to the show, Sarah Beth Gilson. Hey.
Hi, Lisa. How are you?
Doing well. Very good to have you. So we've got a good roundup of folks here. And of course, I'm here always with an opinion, but I'm going to try to hold back so I can let these people talk today as well. So we're going to talk about living arrangements. And this is born out of a few emails that we've received from single young adults who are kind of like, okay, I'm like 25, 26, 27. What really should I be doing? Should I still be at home? Should I be out getting my own apartment? Should I be buying a home? One of our folks even wrote in and said that they were invited to be like part of this Christian intentional community house of like 10 people. And that was going to be all kinds of commitment, it seems, to be in regular meals, prayer, Bible studies, and also outreaching to those in their community who don't follow Christ. So a lot of options out there. And I know in different phases of young adulthood and singleness, we probably have done a number of these ourselves or kind of moved into different phases or anticipating moving into other phases. So we're going to get your opinions on what has worked, what hasn't, and kind of what would be what you feel is kind of good for different seasons of life. So let's go ahead and throw it out there. Let's talk about where we are right now, first of all, in our living situation and kind of where maybe we've been, if we've been anywhere differently. So, Andrew, why don't you start?
Sure. I've had a lot of different living situations since I moved to Colorado after graduating from college. Actually, I think I've moved 9 times.
Whoa.
And a lot of times it's because, you know, I'm renting a house.
Because you got
from
kicked
somebody.
Out.
Yeah.
I mean, let's just be
for
honest.
Bad behavior.
Okay.
Yeah. No, but a lot of I've actually lived in a lot of houses where the house was sold out from under me. We were renting it. We wanted to extend our lease, and the owner decided to sell. And so, which with the housing bubble, that probably turned out to be a good move in a lot of cases. But anyway, but this isn't about that. But I've lived, I actually, during seminary, lived with a family from church invited me to just, you know, live with them. And that was a neat opportunity. I've lived with a lot of different groups of guys, friends that I had, where we just kind of did life together, usually renting a place. Actually one time, Anthony's here on the podcast too. We both have lived in a mansion. Older Christian gentleman who didn't have a family opened up his big house to a lot of young guys preparing for ministry, and it was huge. I mean, it was a $1.5 million house and had a basketball court in the gym and
full theater.
Yeah.
How'd you lose that gig? What happened?
He died.
Oh. He's,
passed
okay.
away. rest
well.
In peace, Bob. But yeah. So anyway, but well. Bob was just really generous in life and, So we both left that situation. But now I actually currently live with a gentleman who is just renting me a room. I was living with a group of guys, and that house got sold out from under us. And instead of going and find another house, we all kind of had to spread out. It was kind of we had to find something quick. So I'm living with a gentleman close to where I work and looking to move back in with guys that I can kind of have community with.
Okay.
So that's my story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, since college, I've also moved quite a bit, and I've lived everywhere from a mansion to a actual shack for varying periods of time with, you know, very varying degrees of, you know, varying, like, numbers of roommates. Right now I'm married and renting a house, and I've locked in a really, really amazing price for a house that is, like, far below the market value, so it's kind of hard to leave.
Hmm.
But I have two kids, so
yeah,
that has to happen.
Yeah. You need the space.
So the
exactly. Yeah.
So obviously the multiple roommates thing had to be, you know, you had to ratchet it down now that you have a family. You're just family.
Yeah, you know, after I had
no
my
wonder
second
you had to kick
kid,
Andrew I out. It was finally
exactly.
like, dude, yeah, you're done.
I was like, dude, my daughter needs your bedroom, so leave.
Yeah, okay. I took the high road and left.
Okay, that's good.
I actually moved home with my parents after I graduated college. So right now I live with my parents and my 17-year-old brother.
Okay. So kind of different situations. And I've definitely had roommates as well throughout, you know, post-college and stuff like that. And then several years ago, bought a home, had a roommate there for a while, and then she went off to seminary and never got a roommate since, and kind of have gotten used to living alone, which I guess is doable because I talk to people all day here. So that's probably why it's sustainable. But, you know, at times I think it can get lonely, and I miss kind of those days of camaraderie and roommates and kind of having people in my life consistently, and not having to mop the kitchen floor myself all the time. I would definitely love someone else who had to share that responsibility. But so what would you guys say as you look on your current situation or past ones or whatever, what has been ideal about it and what has been kind of, you know, something that you wish you would have had, kind of looking at, you know, what's worked, what hasn't?
I think for me, the thing that has been the best part of certain living situations is the community that naturally comes from a living situation. Even when I was living at the mansion with some guys, they were really my friends, and we did a lot of things together, and we really, you know, we were community, we weren't just roommates. And that was really good. I think there's a lot of built-in accountability there where we could push each other more than if it's just somebody who's, you know, kind of helping me foot the bill. And so that was really good. Negative situations are, you know, sometimes when you're living with people, you have people that just get under your skin. And so I think one of the things to be really careful about is really seeing this as an interview process where you're really deciding, is this wise for us to live together? Because I think sometimes in the Christian community, we're like, oh, we should just be able to get along with anybody. It's like, well, that's true. But living together is you're constantly going to have to deal with things. So yeah, I think it is wise to think through, okay, or is this a good fit? Because it can be really miserable to have roommates that you just don't get along. And
yeah, I definitely had that one time. I had a roommate, just one other girl, and she was totally like looking to me as her psychotherapist. Like every night it was like unloading super negativity and all that, like a lot of drama and a lot of just griping and everything. And then my next situation was there were four of us girls, and I was like, oh, this is so great, because you could all kind of play off of one another. No one had to be that one person for the other person. So yeah. I noticed that was a huge, you know, that was a huge benefit. But
yeah, I think having at least three people kind of helps you escape that, you know, that trap of just being too much weight on that one-to-one relationship. And I think for me, things that I've lacked in the past with roommates, and I've also experienced it, is intentionality. And so, like Andrew was saying, in terms of like interviewing your possible housemates or roommates, you know, you want to choose people that are going to like benefit you in your spiritual walk and be intentional with you in doing life, and not just people that, you know, walk in and out the door that you never really talk to.
Mm-hmm. For me, it's been a really big adjustment going from college to living at my parents' house. In college, I lived in a sorority house with 40 other women. And all of a sudden, I'm home, and it's me and my 17-year-old brother. And as crazy as it is, it's harder to share a bathroom with my 17-year-old brother than it was with 40 other women in the sorority house.
Wow. Okay. Now, and how have you negotiated the transition back home, Sarah Beth, to like dealing with, do your parents have rules, or kind of how have you felt like you've lost some independence? Are you trying to kind of have to establish that, or what does that look like?
My parents definitely have the same expectations and responsibilities laid on me that I had when I was in high school, especially in regards to kind of family time and prioritizing going to my brother's football games or track meets or that kind of thing so that we can all spend time together. But at the same time, I'm in graduate school, I'm working full time, I'm volunteering in youth ministry, and I'm volunteering as an advisor for my sorority. So I'm not home as frequently as I was in high school.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Now, have you guys ever thought, I mean, do you have this expectation, whether spoken or not, in your head? And of course, Anthony, you're now married. So it was kind of like you were pushed, you know, in this direction for sure. But do you have this expectation of like you do living at home for a while and you do roommates for a while and then maybe you live with an older person for a while and then eventually you should get your own place? Or have you felt pressure in any of those directions to do a certain way of living? Or have you kind of bounced back and forth without it being a big deal?
I feel that a little bit more because both my brothers are homeowners. And so I'm kind of like, it's natural for me to think that way. But I actually enjoy the freedom of not having a place because I feel like there are a lot of ways, like things that I could do in my life where it would take me away from Colorado Springs. Like I love my life here and love what I'm doing here. But there's times where I've thought about, you know, going and getting a PhD or doing other things like that. And so for me, not owning a place and renting gives me that freedom where I literally could pick up and go if God called me to do that or if I decided that was the best thing for me. So I've kind of thought of it that way. And there's times where I'm like, it makes sense for me to buy a house. And I've even thought about it as an investment where I could buy a house, rent out the rooms, and people could pay my mortgage. And that it might be a wise thing to do financially. But I do think that that expectation of, you know, you haven't arrived as an adult until you own a home. I think we need to be wise with that because I kind of feel like as soon as I bought a home, like somebody would call me from, you know, Orlando, like, hey, we want you to come be a part of this church plant. And I'd be like, oh, yeah, but what about this house I just bought? So, again, that's just there's balance there, I think.
Yeah. Before I got married, I was not even thinking about buying a house because I was mostly planning on staying as free as possible. Just like Andrew said, basically for, you know, anything that might come up. And then once I decided to get married, I kind of wished I had been thinking more along those lines. I think that if that is something that's kind of like, you know, like on your heart and maybe near in your future, then that might be one reason to kind of start looking in that direction and saving up for a down payment and stuff. But it's probably unwise to feel pressure to buy a house and then do so without, you know, like a healthy down payment and stuff like that. So, feeling pushed into it when you're not ready is not smart. So.
Now, one of the female listeners who wrote in was talking about her as a single woman buying a home. And we've talked about that a little bit at Boundless, and Candace has written on it. And she was wondering, you know, she feels like there's this perception that single women take themselves off the market when they decide to buy homes. And then they're just kind of like, oh, okay, now I'm just single and loving it and I'm going to be successful and just, you know, pull myself up by my bootstraps or whatever. Do you as guys feel that? Is there that kind of idea? Or?
Not at all.
No way.
I think that, I mean, I think...
I think it'd be awesome that's like, you know, back in the old days, you know, this is kind of a stupid thing to say, but like, you know, a dowry would come with all this stuff. So essentially, like, if your wife or your future spouse is wise enough to have purchased a house and taken care of that properly, then that's just more economic value for the two of you. So awesome.
Okay.
Yeah. I think when that's just evidence that a woman is wise with her money and in putting it into things that will last. So I think that, I mean, guys that are paying attention, that should be something that is attractive to a guy, a woman that handles her finance as well. And I think that's the evidence of that in most cases.
Okay.
So I do think, like, going on the last thing we talked about too, that you can not want to buy a house in the next year or so and still run your finances preparing for it. I think that's an important point because I think sometimes singles are like, yeah, I'm not looking to buy a house. And so they don't budget preparing. And so you might even want to have a budget line for a future home that I would want to buy for years, even though you're not even thinking about buying right now. I think a lot of times we get into traps of, oh, I'm just going to, you know, make sure that, you know, I'm making more than I'm spending without really thinking about the big things you want to save for it. Because especially like Anthony, you know, like if, you know, if in the next year or so I got married, I'm going to be glad that I have been saving for that, even though I was thinking the whole time, yeah, I'm not going to buy right now because who knows?
Okay. And Sarah Beth, kind of where's your thought process? I mean, are you thinking you're kind of doing this indefinitely or are you kind of saying, okay, I'm doing this to prepare for some other step?
I actually have a friend that we're beginning the apartment hunt. She has been living with her parents also, and she's the oldest of seven. And there's still 5 of the 7 living at home.
Okay.
So she's really had an adjustment back home, and we're both kind of ready to have some sort of independence in a living situation, paying rent, buying our own food, that kind of thing.
Okay. So speaking of which, that kind of brings me on to a little ancillary topic of just living life then on your own, whether you move out on your own with a friend or whether you have a group of roommates or whether you're renting a room or whatever. What's been unique or difficult about navigating that, especially when other people are involved, about like, okay, how do you do groceries? How do you do, you know, how are you in one another's business? How do you do times of who's at the house when and vacations and stuff like that?
Yeah, that, and that's stuff you have to talk about because most of the situations I've had, it's just been natural where we don't eat each other's food or, you know, it's just pretty, everybody's pretty laid back about it.
We don't eat each
other's
food. Yeah. Somebody
eats my food.
Yeah.
It'll be bad times.
Okay.
No, just kidding. But I do think those are things to talk about. Actually, one time there were three of us who were moving into a place and we were looking for a fourth roommate, and we actually put an ad on the folks on the Family Leadership Institute has kind of an internal push to all alumni. And so we kind of sent out a blast like, hey, we're looking for a fourth roommate in the Springs, and found a fourth roommate. And we actually had an interview at Chick-fil-A. We went and just met this guy that we didn't know. And I was literally asking him, like, what do you like? What things annoy you? Thinking I want to make sure that we're not going to annoy you that's how I was thinking about it. And he actually turned into be one of our great friends. Like, I mean, he's a good friend, and we had a really good time living together. And but those are the kind of things that I was asking, like, you know, what do you like to be at home a lot? Do you like to be out a lot? You know, are you a night person or a morning person? Because I'm a morning person. Like, I'll be, you know, stirring around the kitchen at 6 a.m. And usually I live with people that are not that way and think I'm nuts, but just read the Bible. That's how Jesus was. But things like that are good to think about. And it doesn't mean it's a deal breaker. I mean, I'm really careful in the mornings. And if I go to bed before everybody else, you know, they try to keep quiet. But it's just about a matter of living together.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Anthony, how would you say that your multiple living situations pre-marriage prepared you for marriage?
I would say the biggest lesson I learned before marriage and living with people is the importance of intentionality and of being upfront with expectations. And so all of that is amply more important with a spouse. So like with roommates, you know, learning the value of almost like creating a contract of I'm responsible for this and you're responsible for this. And these are my peeves and these are my my weaknesses that other people are often peeved about with me and all that. So yeah, like communicating all those issues as much as possible is extremely helpful with anyone, and especially a spouse. Yeah,
That's good. So any other advice you would give to folks, I mean, who are looking, you know, there are a lot of people in our audience who probably are just post-college now, and they're kind of wondering, okay, where do I land? I don't want to get stuck in anything weird, or I don't want to be in a situation that's, you know, kind of that balance of, okay, I don't want to be tied down too much, but at the same time, I want to be responsible and I want to have people in my life, because that's very difficult for single people. And of course, you know, being with family like Sarah Beth is naturally that's going to breed that. Maybe living with roommates or living with a family is more difficult to get that. But what would you guys say, just best practices?
Yeah, I think when you're looking for roommates or a place to live, start it with your church or churches in the area. I've done that several times. Actually, that's how we found the mansion originally was, you know, he had posted.
What church do you go to?
Yeah, I don't want to say.
Okay.
They'll get bombarded with calls. But but actually, I mean, just calling and saying, hey, because a lot of times people have rooms to rent. They'll let big churches in the area know. And so that's a good. And then also just ask, letting it known that you're looking for people, like, you know, Facebook is a great way to just let people know, hey, I'm looking for a roommate or I'm looking for a different living situation. And those are people that you trust. I would caution against a Craigslist or kind of just using a general way to find a place to live, because, I do think that, you know, living with believers is going to protect you from a lot of stuff that if you just live with a bunch of guys that don't share your faith, you might, or girls, you might just be pulled into stuff or have stuff happening at your house that you're not really excited about as somebody who is full of Christ love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say that, like, you know, choosing godly, inspiring people to live with, and not making your housing situation your witness field necessarily. Like, choosing equally yoked people or people that will kind of like draw you up, to be, you know, more into Christ is hugely important. So yeah, leaning on your network, if you don't know people like that, then like putting the word out in churches and with people that know who you are and might be more connected to like connect you with people that would be a healthy situation. Yeah.
I've actually been praying over my roommate situation. She and I have known each other since she was in sixth grade and I was in seventh grade when we lived in Minot, North Dakota. And both of our families happened to retire here. And so it's kind of been an answer to prayer that we would both be ready to kind of move out of our families' houses at the same time and have that shared history and relationships that we really kind of understand each other and know where the other one is at and where they're coming from.
Yeah, that's really good. Which is also kind of hard, too, because you actually care about one another as friends. Right. So you can't have that kind of, you know, neutral, like, mm-hmm. oh, you're just my roommate. So mm-hmm. you're going to have all kinds of drama. We'll probably have you back to talk about that, too. So that'll be good. Well, I will say, as we wrap up here, and thanks you guys so much for sharing, that stay tuned for the next segment with Glenn Stanton, because we haven't even addressed the idea of cohabitation. And I know I get a lot of questions from single young adults who are like, well, if we have this big house of people, does it really matter if it's guys and girls and all that kind of stuff? So we're going to talk about that a little bit as well and throw that into the mix because we haven't really even brought that up in this conversation. But thanks for the great tips, you guys, and good stories. And hopefully that is helpful for all of you out there as you evaluate your current living situation or thinking of moving and just thinking of what that looks like as you mature in adulthood and how that involves community around you and the way you live. So thanks, you guys.
Thanks.
Sure.
Thanks, Lisa.
Everyone has a heart that's burning for more. A greater need than this world could ever afford. And you are the one that we've been searching for. We've been searching for. Nothing satisfies like the love that I've found in you.
Well, hello, everyone. We are here with this week's culture segment. Glenn Stanton's with me in the studio. Hey, Glenn.
Hello, Lisa. How are you?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Good. I'm pretty good.
Okay. I am recently back from the Caribbean, which excites me.
Wow.
Well, I mean, it doesn't excite me that I'm back because now it's like practically snowing outside today.
I wonder where that golden tan came from.
Well, let's just be honest. Martha told me I did not even look tan, which I was quite offended by.
Hmm.
I tried to just work through it.
Martha was jealous.
She was.
That was.
She was. That's what I think. So I'm
Martha
just,
says
I had to
constantly
let it go.
That you're not so great.
Right.
So I don't know if those two things had anything
next
to do.
Next time Martha is on the show, she's going to have to set that record straight.
Yeah.
We'll see. We'll just pit you against her about comments about Lisa. We'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Caribbean.
Well,
so where'd you go?
Six islands. It was great. Yeah. It was a 12-day cruise.
That's
three
fantastic.
Of my girlfriends. So it was great. Yeah.
Good
we
for
had
you.
A, we had a good time. We thought it was going to be like super oldsters, which it kind of was.
Yeah.
And then just a lot of like eating and casinos, but we actually did a lot of stuff. Awesome snorkeling. It was really a lot of fun. So
good.
Highly recommend it. Anyway, here we are. But I could not stay away from Boundless any longer.
Mm-hmm.
I had to get back. So here we are.
Yeah.
Okay.
Glad you're back.
I know. I am too. You are the author of many books and many papers. Mm-hmm. Some, and you know, like papers and stuff like that. These aren't things that, like, you know, it's not something that everyone would read. Sometimes you just sit down with sociologists and talk about stuff that we don't know about, basically. But you do a good job of making it understandable for us lay people, what we need to know related to marriage, parenting, the family unit in general. Good stuff. Today we're going to talk about cohabitation, because you wrote The Ring Makes All the Difference, a book. What did that come out about 2 years ago now?
End of 2011.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So a little while.
Relatively recently, but yeah.
Okay. I want to know from you, just to kick it off, why, okay, when we talk about cohabitation, I mean, it's something now that just everyone is like, yeah, you know, okay, whatever. It's, people are doing it. But what has changed recently? And by recently, I mean, like, let's talk about the last 20 years. How, really, how have statistics changed on this? How has the whole landscape of this idea changed? And quite frankly, how has it infiltrated the church?
Well, those are good questions. And, you know, the overall question is quite dramatically to each of those. First of all, the growth of cohabitation. It really started to grow significantly in the 70s and 80s. But the most significant growth, spiking growth, has been in the last 10 years. And there is just no other family form or relationship model that is growing as fast as cohabitation is. I mean, there's just no close competitor. But it's interesting, one of the big, big changes, and I talk about that in the book, is cohabitation used to derive from a sort of anti-marriage sentiment. Oh, marriage is just a piece of paper. Who needs it? We don't need a judge to certify our love. That just, you know, makes it all mechanical. But today, many young people, most people, in fact, a little more than 75% are cohabiting out of what I call a pro-marriage view. And that is, they're cohabiting, seeing cohabitation as a kind of testing ground for marriage, or at least just a placeholder. Is, you know, I want to marry one day. It's a very real desire and interest for me, but I'm scared of failing at it, so I'll just kind of do a training wheel sort of relationship. Or rather than dive into the deep end of the relationship marriage pool, I'm going to wade in carefully. And I can understand that, because this generation is just absolutely shell-shocked by the failure across the board of marriage that they've seen in their own families, own communities, things like that. So they are cohabiting, oddly enough, out of kind of a pro-marriage sentiment. And we'll talk about whether that's a wise choice, whether it's a smart choice, but that's the motivation, and that's why they're doing it.
Yeah, so let's break that down a little bit, specifically for men and women, because I think there are probably some unique reasons for each of them going into this. Like, why would you say, why do men agree to this, and why do women agree to it?
You know what, that is a big, big, important question, and I think, you know, not to brag, not to toot my own horn, but this book is one of the first books to really address that question, is the gender difference in cohabitation. And men and women, they did this research. They gathered a lot of cohabiting couples, hundreds, and they divided the men up and they divided the women up and asked them about the intentions and desires and goals for cohabiting. One group was most likely to say, we're just hanging out, having fun, just kind of seeing what happens. Another group, and I won't say which gender was which, but another group said, oh yeah, we're on the road to marriage. We're moving in that direction, and it's just a matter of time until, you know, we get serious about that. You know, can you guess which ones were the men, which ones were the women? The women were obviously the ones who said, you know, this relationship is moving toward marriage. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that mean? That means that those women, given the men's interest of just, you know, what we're hanging out, having fun, just seeing what happens, that those women are holding out a false hope that their relationship is moving toward marriage, when for the guy, it's just, you know what? Everything's working out. Things seem to be okay. Maybe we'll talk about marriage next year. Maybe we won't. marriage is the relationship on the woman's terms. Cohabitation is the relationship on the man's terms. And that's one of the big, big findings coming out of this book is really just how true that is and why it's true.
Yeah. So do you think it's like women especially, do you think they just don't know this? Because really, I've heard you say before how much guys benefit from a cohabiting relationship, mm-hmm. where women are kind of giving up a lot and are getting the short end of the stick.
They really are. They're giving.
Give us some examples.
Yeah, they're giving up more. But first of all, I mean, do women realize this? Women don't realize this. They think that if they can, you know, domesticate or move in, what I like to say, if you know, they can start their get their guy washing dishes, having, you know, cleaning the toilet, that's the conveyor belt to marriage, that it's an inevitable transition into marriage at some point. It's not. Mm-hmm. You know, it's they've kind of got what they want. They've got somebody to keep them company. They've got somebody to cook for them, clean for them. They've got somebody, an additional income to draw off of. And of course, they have access to regular sex, mm-hmm. you know, which is a big thing for a guy. Mm-hmm. But it's important to understand that women who are cohabiting tend to be less happy than women that are married. Men that are cohabiting and women that are cohabiting tend to be less faithful to their partners. I think women just tend to be more faithful generally, but cohabiting women tend to be less faithful because they are looking for something relationally, emotionally, that the cohabiting relationship and the lack of commitment is just not likely to provide for the woman. It's interesting that the process of cohabiting makes the man less committed to the current cohabiting relationship and to marriage later when it happens, either to his girlfriend that he's living with or somebody else. That is not found among women at all. So cohabitation does not make women any less committed to the relationship, but it does for the man. Ladies, if that's what you're looking for, then cohabitation is exactly what you want. Hmm. I mean, it's really remarkable how cohabitation really cheats the woman and what she's looking for in the relationship.
Yeah. I was also pretty surprised, things that you talk about in the book and you and I have discussed, just some of the other statistics related to cohabiting couples and, you know, related. Talk a little bit about what you found in terms of divorce, if they get to marriage, abuse. I mean, some of that stuff that I think people have turned a blind eye to.
Oh, absolutely. And this is all based on the leading academic secular research. It's not conservative research. It's not Christian research. These are mainstream academics. And it's not cherry picking either. I mean, the research on this question of how cohabitation serves to either improve or hurt relationships is vast, strong, and very conclusive. First of all, like I said earlier, we have so many young people cohabiting, thinking that it's going to lead to a stronger, healthier, happy relationship and marriage. Absolutely not true. That those who cohabit increase their risk of possible divorce when they do marry by 50 to 80%. The mean in there is about 65%. So when you think about your risk of divorce just generally marrying today, unfortunately, is pretty high based on some different characteristics. You elevate that by 50 to 80% is just stunning. In fact, just to shortcut it, the process of cohabiting and the experience of cohabiting increases your betterment or likelihood of anything good in no way. In fact, it mitigates against it very seriously. There is nothing that the process of cohabitation increases or improves, according to the research. There's just nothing there. And marriage, the process of being married, does elevate nearly every measure of human well-being, and cohabitation doesn't. And it's not only that it just kind of stays neutral, it actually negatively impacts it. So the question is, if you want higher likelihood of divorce, if you want more domestic violence in your relationship, if you want to be more likely ladies to be working outside the home, have to be working, but still live in greater poverty, given that, then cohabitation is exactly what you're looking for. Cohabitation has a real effect, and it's negative on the lives of individuals, women particularly, and the relationship itself.
Hmm. One thing I always tell women, just in what I've learned through your stuff, especially about cohabitation, is that it also tends to keep women, especially in bad relationships.
Right.
Because once you have shared space, then maybe you have shared property. I mean, I know some people that buy a house together, or even, they get a dog together. And then mm-hmm. it's like, well, this guy's a jerk, but we can't break up because we have this dog. And what are we going to do with that? And I just find that, I find so many women that feel themselves stuck in these relationships.
And that's exactly right. The kind of feminist who thought cohabitation would be a good idea thought that it would empower women. If mm-hmm. it's not a good relationship, you can just take off. Mm-hmm. Well, it's what the scholars call the relational vortex, and it's exactly what you said. It's the entanglement of this life together. And I know this is not a good relationship. My friends tell me it's not a good relationship. My parents tell me the same thing. But given debt, given economic dependency, given emotional dependency, even things like the dog and stuff like that, I don't mm-hmm. feel like I can leave the relationship. It's not that divorce out of marriage is a good thing, but divorce is at least a process, a legal process that says, the law is going to protect both people and watch out for both people. There is not that in cohabitation. And so we find that the woman has lessened negotiating power for ending the relationship. It's more, again, on the guy's terms, and that she's not going to be protected emotionally, economically, property-wise in leaving the relationship. So she's more likely to feel like, I've got to stay in a bad relationship for all these other reasons, even though I know it's not good for me emotionally, physically, spiritually, sexually.
Okay. So the number one argument that I hear for cohabitation, and I hear this among Christians as well, why many Christian couples are moving towards cohabitation, is, but how in the world are we truly going to test out our compatibility and, question 1A, our sexual compatibility, mm-hmm. unless we are living together and I know what he's like when he's throwing his socks on the floor and I know what it's like to have to share grocery bills and do this and really test it out and live it out and know what it's like to be tied to him sexually or whatever. How do you respond to that?
You know what? I mean, in a sense, not to be mean and ugly, but that is just an ignorant line of reasoning from many perspectives. One, as if you can enter a relationship without the commitment and experience it as marriage. The sociologists say the number one problem with cohabitation is the relational ambiguity, a fancy word for what they say. It's not clear what the guy is looking for and how he evaluates the relationship or the girl. Mm-hmm. They typically...
We know a lot about relational ambiguity at Boundless. This is just another
That's
caveat.
That's the tagline another of caveat, Boundless,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
But it's the commitment, and mm-hmm. it's the commitment that matters. I mean, even historically, it's kind of crazy. So we have just started, quote unquote, testing out relationships recently, mm-hmm. coinciding with the decline of relational happiness and longevity. Back in the days, they didn't test out relationships, and people were married a lifetime. They weren't always happy. But for the most part, they were really quite happy. So even that line of reasoning just goes against experience and history mm-hmm. in that it just doesn't work out. And again, if that did prove itself, then the process of cohabitation would be shown to cut down on unhappy, unhealthy relationships. And just the opposite is true. And again, this is not just in a couple of studies. This is in study after study after study that the sociologists themselves have a term for it. And it's called the cohabitational effect. You ask sociologists what they think about the cohabitational effect, they will know exactly what you're talking about. And that is that the process of cohabiting tends to make relationships less healthy. There's no question about that. The question in the academic literature is, why is that? So, you know, for any couple who says, well, we're not like the norm, we're not like anybody else. Well, you might not be, but it's like smoking. You know what? My grandpa smoked till he was 98. He wasn't like anybody else. Is anybody going to go, well, Glenn's grandpa, he did fine, so I'm going to just start doing it. You know what? The likelihood of your future relational prospects being improved by cohabitation are dramatically low. The likelihood of them being significantly damaged and unhealthy is significantly high.
Okay. So in the last couple minutes that we have here, I just want to talk a little bit about kind of a version of cohabitation. That's another thing we hear from a lot of young adult singles, especially Christians, is, okay, well, a bunch of friends and I want to move into this house and kind of have this just big co-ed kind of dorm situation. My take on that, and I've said this before, is, you know, there are some things that are illegal, some are immoral, and some are just stupid, going in for that. But is that, I mean, are you seeing an increase in that kind of trend? And what's your thought? I mean, what would you say to young adults that say, oh, no, we're not attracted to one another. We're just platonic friends.
Yeah. And I do hear that a lot. And it is in the stupid category. And primarily because even I hear it from couples that are attracted to one another, but they'll just say, but you know what, we're not having sex. As if sex is the only kind of intimacy that there is. I mean, that's so limited and so kind of unintelligent, if you will. I mean, just to be frank, there are lots of different kinds of intimacies. When Jackie and I were dating and we looked forward to getting married, I looked forward to waking up in the morning with her in our pajamas and having cereal together, you know, because that was an intimacy. To be able to lay on the couch at night together in our pajamas watching TV. Of course, the sexual part was a big part, but there are these other intimacies. Having, brushing your teeth in the same bathroom and often at the same time is an intimacy. You know, again, eating breakfast together in your pajamas, you know, pouring your cereal together, that's a very intimate kind of thing. And it's not just sexual intimacy that God doesn't want us to experience before marriage, but all these other intimacies that are a part of that. And so it really is quite naive to think that, well, sexual intimacy is the only intimacy that we need to guard against. No, it's all these other intimacies, and a relationship and an emotional bond is being built there when you engage with these things, even if you don't have a romantic interest in that individual. And you know what? Later on when you're married, tell your wife that, oh yeah, I lived with Susie and, you know, we had the best time in the morning waking up in our pajamas and making pancakes together. And see if your wife is just cool with that, you know?
Yeah. All right. Well, this is why I had to tell JFK Jr. I could not live with him back
and that
in the
was
day.
Wise.
I know. It's where I had to go because I just knew no good could come of that.
Yeah.
All right. So, last question for the person. We just need kind of this in an elevator speech. So my friend just told me she's going to move in with her boyfriend, and I just have one shot to be like, this is not wise. What do I tell her as the best argument for why she should reconsider what she's doing?
Real quick, sister, there is no good reason. And if you think there's a good reason, go find me evidence in any bit of research. And in the social sciences, you can't really ever use the phrase ever or always. But on this one, you can. There just simply is no evidence for that. And anything that they think is going to be positive exists only in their mind.
Okay. So keep your dog to yourself, people. Just keep your dog under your name, vet bills, everything.
Absolutely.
Don't be sharing that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
All right, Glenn, thanks so much. Again, the book is The Ring Makes All the Difference, The Hidden Consequences of Cohabitation and the Strong Benefits of Marriage. We've been talking to Glenn Stanton.
If you'll do a favor, all the listeners, tell your parents that you're thinking about cohabiting and that you need this book and that it might prevent you from cohabiting. They'll get it for you, and my family would be most thankful, and the publisher would as well.
Well, that's good, and then that'll get them the free book as well. I think this is a good one. That has
everybody wins.
That's good. Awesome. The Ring Makes All the Difference. Thanks, Glenn.
Sure.
We've all been there, we've all felt it. Those times when your back's against the wall, no way out, all your doubt keeps rushing in like a waterfall. If you're out there looking for love, come on.
We are opening up this week's inbox, and Candace Waters is on the phone. Hey, Candace.
Hey, Lisa.
Hello. Great week to you. Glad you're here with us.
I'm glad to be with you always. Glad.
Very fun. Well, we've got a fun question this week, and I think this is one that will perk up the ears of every single female listening, because most of us have been in this situation, and it is the travesty of the non-second date. The waiting by the phone, we all have visions. Well, maybe not all of us, those of us that are somewhat old enough to remember reruns of like Gidget and all that, where she just like sat by the phone, traumatized, waiting for this guy to call her.
Listeners now are going, what's a phone?
Remember? I know. Remember Gidget? Well, no, I remember it was on reruns way back in the day. Anyway, let's hear what this listener has to say. She's saying, I've been on two dates in the last 2 months. I really enjoyed my time and felt that I really connected with the latter date specifically, but he did not ask me on a second date. I trust that God's in control, but I'm a bit frustrated on what I did wrong not to warrant a second date. I really wanted to get to know him more, and I was impressed with his walk with the Lord. What would you suggest so that I stay true to myself and quirkiness, but also get to know these awesome men more?
Okay, well, first of all, you may not have done anything wrong. He may just not have liked you in the way that he would need to like you to ask you out on a second date. And I think that's just a he's not that into you problem. It's frustrating. It's mildly offensive. It's hard to swallow, but not everybody clicks. And that's the mystery of, you know, the man with the maiden. That's the classic Proverbs verse, you know, the four things I don't understand, and one of them is the way of a man with a maiden. It is a mystery what makes two people click. And you can, you know, never, I think no matter how many couples I meet, I still am always perplexed and think, wow, why did those two end up together? Mm-hmm. So I would say relax that there's probably nothing wrong with what you did. However, I would say, okay, in case you are extremely quirky to the point of doing something wrong, ask somebody you trust who knows you very well if they see anything that you might have done that would have turned somebody off. It's always good to get that input. Okay. But my bigger concern with her question is this point she made toward the end about wanting to stay true to herself. Yes, to a point that is helpful advice. She mentioned she's quirky. I think we all are in our own ways, and none of us should pretend to be something we're not in order to attract a man. We shouldn't walk around with this sort of fear of man that says if I act a certain way, then he'll like me, and alter your behavior and alter your personality to fit an idea of what you think he's looking for. That would not be sustainable, because if he does like who you're pretending to be, then what are you going to do? At some point, he's going to find out what you're really like. So you do need to be who you are, who God made you to be. But I think this stay true to yourself sounds kind of like a, you know, pop psychology bumper sticker slogan thing. And the reality is you're supposed to be growing in your Christ-likeness more and more, growing in spiritual maturity and becoming more and more like Jesus. And so you don't want to be true to you. You want to be true to Christ. And as you're growing in your spiritual maturity, I'm assuming, of course, that whoever wrote this question is a believer and is in Christ, and I pray that's the case. Then if marriage is what God has in mind for you, when you meet the man that you're supposed to marry, that will be very attractive to him. And so if you're going to try to alter your personality at all, alter it toward Jesus. Be like him and ask the Lord to work in you during this time of frustration. To thank him for these opportunities to pray that he would sanctify you more. Pray that he would bring good fruit from the disappointment of not being asked out again and say, Lord, how can I be more like your son? Make me into the image of the woman you had in mind when you made me. Help me to grow in maturity. And I think that's where you should put your energy, not in wondering what you could do differently and maybe the kind of joke you tell or, you know, the perfume you wear or how you dress or any of those superficial things.
Yeah, that's good. And I remember after going on a first date with a guy, I was kind of rehashing it with one of my friends. And of course, I thought I was my usual amazing self, of course. And then in me retelling the date, she was kind of like, Lisa, is that really what you asked? Because it sounds like you were interviewing for the Belma show. And I saw how, wow, maybe I could have come across that way as being super. Like sometimes I get so inquisitive. It's like, whoa, give the guy a chance to like speak for himself and not, you know, so I thought that was helpful. One question I do want to ask you, for the guys, because this is a frustration of women, Candace, is, okay, so, you know, women are constantly told, give a guy a chance, give a guy a chance. So these guys, I mean, I've heard so many guys go on a first date with a girl and then he's like, oh, well, it didn't feel natural. It didn't feel comfortable. It didn't feel, well, you know, should it on after a first date? I'm kind of wondering if some of these guys aren't giving it maybe another, you know, because she could have had an off night. It could have been weird. You're trying to think of what to talk about.
I would hope that these guys are in strong churches where they've got older men, elders saying, you know, brother, you're like a six, give her a chance. I mean, I think that's what we pray for. We pray that they're being mentored. We pray that they have good counsel. You know, certainly when Steve and I have a young couple in our home or a single man, I take every opportunity to encourage them that way. But I mean, you get what you get, you know, and you don't know if the man that you had that date with has that kind of input. And so pray for that, certainly. But at the end of the day, go back to what she started with. I'm trusting God. Okay, God is sovereign. And he's not up in heaven going, oh, no, he didn't give her a second date. What am I going to do now? Mm-hmm. You know, this is not a surprise to the Lord.
Yeah.
And I think we as women really tend to get agitated when things don't go the way we want them to. And I maybe guys are the same way, but I just know what it's like to be a woman. And I know that I see when I was single, I used to meet a guy and think, oh, he's so godly, he'd be so perfect. And then it just kind of fizzled out and you're just so tempted to be stressed about that and anxious. And really, it's a reminder that we are not in control and that there's nothing we can do by worrying to change any of the outcome. We need to be intentional. We need to be purposeful and good stewards of the opportunities God gives us. But then we really do need to let it go and say, okay, Lord, I trust that you'll bring the outcome you want.
Yeah, very good. Good point and good perspective. So cool. Well, thank you, Candace, for giving some advice and input on that. Okay, everyone, that is it for this week's show. Write to us at editor@boundless.org so we can answer your question in the future because we want to do that. Hopefully you have found our advice section on the site where we have kind of put as a repository all of our Q&A's from the site that Candace and Scott Croft are currently answering. And of course, you can now find inboxes from the show by segment because we've broken up the show. So hopefully you'll find it easier to find answers to your specific questions. Let us know how that is working out. Write to us, editor@boundless.org. That is it for this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of boundless.org. Focus on the family.
A donor-supported ministry of Focus on the Family.